I'm going to keep biographical introductions to a minimum because you've all got the information on the paper, and I don't think there's really any point in me reading things out that you can read yourself. Aside from the fact that I'll now introduce Esther Leslie, who's Professor of Political Aesthetics at Birkbeck College. So, Esther, thank you.
Thank you. First, an apology. I've been in Bergen at a conference all week, and this meant that I didn't have time to get the images together that I would have liked to have shown you. So it's just an apology for a rather lackluster display there. And also, I mean, I feel there's this missing bit somehow in what I'm saying. So I'm hoping discussions and hearing other papers will maybe help me to crystallize this. So I'm just apologizing for a kind of sense of how it could have been, maybe. So let us start. Where am I? Oh, no, wrong one. Okay. That's it. And Walter Benjamin's memoiristic One Way Street, which was written in the mid-1920s, comes out of the turmoil of busy urban streets of modern Germany. But the opening vignettes take us through a series of spaces which are interiors, more or less. The first one is an urban one, to be sure. It's a filling station where Benjamin makes the polemical demand to abandon the book in favour of a writing born of action and embodied in the rapid responses of leaflets, placards, articles and brochures. And after this appeal to his fellow litterateurs to be more like mechanics, injecting a little opinionated oil into this or that part of the vast apparatus of modern social existence, Benjamin's text turns suddenly inward, and we find ourselves in the breakfast room. Breakfast room takes us inside a house and to the transitional space and time between sleeping and waking. He recounts how there's a popular tradition that dreams should not be related on an empty stomach. For in this state, though awake, one remains under the sway of the dream, for washing brings only the surface of the body and the visible motor functions into the light, while in the deeper strata, even during the morning ablution, the grey penumbra of dream persists, and indeed in the solitude of the first waking hour consolidates itself. So our surfaces may be wiped clean, but our hidden depths are still suffused by the mire of the dream. Refusing to eat, Benjamin states, is the strategy of one who would shun the day, who refuses to lose the sense of being under the sway of the dream. That retained source might then be combusted, he says, in a morning's work. The dream can be transmuted into creative work, perhaps writing. More likely, though, the dreamer eats breakfast, dissipates the dream, compacts it deep inside the self once more, and so reaches its further side, which Benjamin calls memory. Dream contents transmute into buried memories. Benjamin's text then lands us in the ambit of memory too. The next section is titled 113. It's divided into subsections or rooms. The first section or room is the cellar, which appears under the motto, I think the whole thing appears under the motto, the house that holds the figure and the form have run their course within the house of the dream. This line is one of Benjamin's own compositions from a cycle of sonnets that he wrote upon learning of the death of a boyhood friend, Fritz Heinle, a comrade in the youth movement, who killed himself in protest at the outbreak of the First World War. The line suggests that the house is a dream or the dream is a house. The vignette that follows develops this sense of the house as a shape from a dream, and as a repository of memory, a place in which things, objects, treasures are stored away, such as our dream thoughts and memories, only to re-emerge after a ransacking, a raid, a violent act, or a wrenching into the day. Cellar. We've long forgotten the ritual by which the house of our life was erected, but when it is under assault and enemy bombs are already taking their toll, What enervated, perverse antiquities do they not lay bare in the foundations? What things were interred and sacrificed amid magic incantations? What horrible cabinet of curiosities lies there below, where the deepest shafts are reserved for what is most commonplace? In a night of despair, I dreamed I was with my first friend from my school days, whom I had not seen for decades, though, and had scarcely ever remembered in that time, tempestuously renewing our friendship and brotherhood. But when I awoke, it became clear that what despair had brought to light, like a detonation, was the corpse of that boy who had been immured as a warning that whoever one day lives here may in no respect resemble him. Our life is a house. We forget how it came to take on the shape it did from a million tiny events and non-events. Foundational for the house of the self is the cellar, which is the oldest part of the house self. We store so much there, we stuff it up. Some of this process is brutal and compulsory, such as the character of ritual. It involves the sacrifice of other possibilities. Some of the processes are magical, touched by odd logics or none. And we've forgotten so much of it until the moment when the house of the self is under sustained assault. Time, history, war, social change produces a rubble, a ruination of the physical world, but also the psychical world. As the self shatters, perverse antiquities come to the fore. These might be habits, that which is most commonplace and most unconscious, whose origins have never been questioned. These might be forgotten experiences, people, relationships, or objects that were once formative. In Being Smashed to Smithereens, Benjamin looks back across the decades to find that who he was is someone else, as are those he knew or knows no longer. The corpse of the boy may be his friend's or his own. In any case, in its reassembly, it is no longer anyone that he resembles, though it forms part of his foundations. That it exists and comes to light means that he can no longer claim it as his own. In dream, the past can be innocently inhabited. Awake again, all is detonated, or detonation is the awakening. There's no going back. The house of the self carries in it a mausoleum or museum. Benjamin dreams of a friend, someone who once formed the center of his universe but is now forgotten. That friendship, a friendship that shaped Benjamin's world when he was young, becomes a ruin. The relationship is dead because the friend or that self is dead. But such relationships die off all the time anyway. The perverse antiquity which becomes clear to him on awakening is the corpse of a friend, the husk of a relation. It forms the foundation of his being, but it is a died-off part of him until the moment when an existential threat arises and the foundations need examination. He realizes that he too is dead in relation to his previous self. The shock works backwards. It's not a shock that he is no longer what he once was, but rather a shock that he once was what he once was. And he might dream of returning to him, but it will be no more than a dream. There are many instances, for example, in the Arcades Project, where Benjamin shows that it's necessary to enter into the depths, the underworld, the unconscious, in order to awaken to the present. Awakening is a motif in Benjamin, a thoroughly historical recognition of what is in relation to what was. It always arrives after a descent into the depths, the cellar, the confrontation with the dead past, or the cliched skeleton in the cupboard. The friend has become a ghost. The dream conveys a flashing recognition. The Benjamin of the past cannot claim a unity with the past, neither a personal nor a historical one. He's different. The world is different. Indeed, such insight pervades Benjamin's sense of historical movement. For him, there's no continuity of past and present, no progressive development from one thing to the next, one event to the next. Rather, there are episodes, zigzags, discontinuities, and breakages. We dream of fullness, but wake up to a few shards that we hold in our hands. Next, we're taken to another room, a vestibule. The exploration of the house now becomes a tour of a house, such as one might make in a house become museum. We're in the lobby. Benjamin is our guide. as much as the dream guides him. The house into whose vestibule he steps is Goethe's in Weimar, or its dream analogue. Benjamin transposed this dream from his dream almanac that he kept at the time into one-way street. Vestibule. A visit to Goethe's house. I cannot recall having seen rooms in the dream. There was a perspective of whitewashed corridors like those in school. Two elderly English lady visitors and a curator are the dream's extras. The curator requests us to sign the visitor's book lying open on a desk at the farthest end of a passage. On reaching it, I find as I turn the pages, my name already entered in big, unruly, childish characters. Benjamin's encounter with Goethe's house is a return to something foundational in him. The tradition of German letters, perhaps, the deeply buried layers of German classicism that formed him as much as the culture in which he resided. This was the bedrock of his education, though it also arrives as something that no longer resembles itself, as becomes ever more true in its appropriation in the epoch of National Socialism. Benjamin stated blankly in a letter to a friend that his engagement with German letters at just this moment was finished. He'd had an unhappy experience with his teaching habilitation, and one-way street represented for him the beginning of a new, non-literary, more French or surrealist cycle. The dream has landed him and us in Goethe's house. Goethe lives there still, but only just. There is a visitor's book and a curator. Musealization is in process. It's also Benjamin's school, with its long white corridors. The school represented something traumatic for Benjamin, for it was largely pervaded by Prussian discipline and militarism. It was his time in the Free Youth Movement where he found his real education. He returns to his school or to a house. Benjamin had visited Weimar when he was a teenager, and he wrote a note to his oldest friend from there. He visited Weimar again as a student in June 1914, speaking on behalf of the Free Student Movement, some 2 months before his generation's significant encounter with death, the outbreak of the Great War, which occasioned his break with the youth movement's pro-war leader, Gustav Winneken, and the suicides of his comrades, the lovers Fritz Heinle and Rika Seligson. To dream of Goethe's house is to dream the dream of childhood, or better, youth, with its heady mix of promise and disappointment. It's a return to the cusp between the possibilities of that moment and the actuality of a historical nightmare. Of course, then, Benjamin would find his infantile signature in the guest book. He encounters his earlier self there, and presumably upon awakening, finds much that is corpse-like about it. We move to the next room, a dining room. That's the house. Have I got all my slides out of here? Dining hall. In a dream, I saw myself in Goethe's study. It bore no resemblance to the one in Weimar. Above all, it was very small and had only one window. The side of the writing desk abutted on the wall opposite the window. Sitting and writing at it was the poet in extreme old age. I was standing to one side when he broke off to give me a small vase, an urn from antiquity, as a present. I turned it between my hands. An immense heat filled the room. Goethe rose to his feet and accompanied me to an adjoining chamber where a table was set for my relatives. It seemed prepared, however, for many more than their number. Doubtless there were places for my ancestors, too. At the end, on the right, I sat down beside Goethe. When the meal was over, he rose with difficulty, and by gesturing I sought leave to support him. Touching his elbow, I began to weep for emotion. It's the dream house again, a translation of the real one into something that apparently does not resemble itself. Goethe is old, elderliness suffuses the house, as in the elderly English visitors in the previous dream. The oldness contrasts with Benjamin's youthfulness, the child that he once was. Goethe hands Benjamin something antique, a perverse antiquity perhaps. It's an urn. He's passing something on, perhaps a relation to the tradition of German letters. The bequest is perverse because it marks Goethe as a man who resides in the train of antiquity rather than the emergent bourgeois society. Perhaps it signals another type of world, a counterfactual one that Goethe represented as possibility. the energy generated by the exchange is vast, much as is the energy generated by the undispensed dream which combusts into writing. The study where writing occurs is a bewitched space of creative forging and passionate experience. It's left behind as a threshold is crossed to the space of eating. The eating in a dream does not dispense the dream, it nourishes it. Benjamin, the German Jew, his relatives and ancestors are invited to gather at the festive gourd. This may be a reflection on the long-standing, mutually assimilative drive of a certain strain in German culture, one that would be violently suppressed within 10 years. In any case, Benjamin is touched, and so touches the old man. In helping him move, he is moved beyond measure. Are we to take from this that Weimar literature and the humane ideals it represented are frail? Humanity is rescued only for the dream house or museum it is interred. The Benjamin should dream of Goethe's house as a place where working and eating occur side by side is curious. For his experience in 1928, the year One Way Street was published, echoed more the sentiments of the dream in Breakfast Room. Goethe's study, he says, is a place in close proximity, not to a dining table, but a bedchamber, the home of dream, whose energies then combust in creative work. Benjamin visited Goethe's house in June 1928. He'd been commissioned to write an entry on Goethe for the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, and he wrote a sketch about his experience of the house, published as an essay in the literary press that year. There's a strong sense of degeneration, of a sickness plaguing the literary tradition when it is musealized and no longer living. Goethe's frailty in the dream transfers to the remnant artifacts in the museum house. Benjamin writes of how white the museum house is, its stairwell, rooms, showcases. The delicate manuscripts are propped up in cases like patients propped up in hospital beds. He observes how that which we know in sturdy published volumes once existed in this strange, unique handwritten form, wispy and immediate. The originals appear weak, exhausted, and yet at the time of their writing, if the time of their writing could be recovered, they would resonate energetically, marked by shudders that ran through them. The work, he says, emerged of youthful vitality. The child that produced the manuscript has aged, and so has the manuscript, but in their moment of emergence, they were shaken up by the indeterminacy of their proximity to forgetting, annihilation, or the intimation of posthumous fame and memory. That's to say, the shudder is an effect of the openness in history, the fullness contained in the dream, impossibility, not the fragments of what came to be. The museum house is a space of finality. Such sentiments evoke a piece written around the same time about Russian toys, this image. Having visited museums during his stay in Russia at the end of 1926, Benjamin notes that the toys he sees there, the product of peasant handiwork, are very fragile, not just because of their materials, clay and straw and light wood, but also because the entire mode of existence upon which their existence is based, peasant life, is on the point of disappearance. The toys, he says, find a refuge in the museum, an asylum for those passing on. Benjamin turns in his sketch on Goethe's Weimar house to the space in which work went on, the study. It's a primitive room which rejected any luxury. Here the old man celebrated the vastness of the nights with his anxieties, guilt and despair before the hellish dawn of bourgeois comfort began to cast its light in at the window. The threshold proposed here is one that separates a modest world from a decadent one. Important to it is this small step from bed to desk, from sleeping to writing. Anyone who has had the good fortune to be able to collect his thoughts in this space will have experienced in these four little rooms in which Goethe slept, read, dictated, and wrote, the forces that bade a world give him answer when he struck the sounding board of his innermost being. The calmness and simplicity of the space mirrors the interior of the poet, which, struck by the forces held within its small domain, rings out clearly and loudly across the world. The relation, notes Benjamin, is now reversed. The interior is drowned out by the noise of the world, by the street signs on one-way streets and the clatter of cars and films. Now the whole world must be projected into the self in order to elicit a small response from our inner being. This is what Benjamin attempts to do. We, however, have to make an entire world resound in order to cause the feeble overtone of our inner being to ring out. Our houses form us and we form our houses. Our dreams and our things are stored in us and in them. This process is not simply an individual one, but collective and subject to historical pressures. There's a cross-language pun to be made. The German Bildung means formation, education. It interested the liberal and progressive bourgeoisie as an idea. The sound of the word echoes the English word building. In fact, both have their origin in the Proto-Indo-European verb to be, to exist or grow. Inner world and house intermingle, but the lesson of modernity is that city environments cut across this relation. The street cuts through the self and its houses, as the dedication of one-way street suggests in its mention of a dual cutting, one by Benjamin's Bolshevik lover, emotional, formational, and one by the engineers of a modern world. If houses form the self, cradling dreams and dreams transmission into work, Benjamin's experience after the publication of One Way Street was aptly enough that of a succession of homes, selves, and incomplete and interrupted projects. He largely abandoned Germany after this point, living where he could find refuge in Europe. With his precarious mode of employment as a freelance writer, he was always searching for the cheapest place to exist, to eat, to sleep, to read, to write. He reports in a diary in 1932 that, having spent all his money, he considered living in a cave in Capri. He would endure any deprivation not to have to return to Berlin. The next entry in that same diary turns such a theme of lack into a modernist gesture, as perversely affirmative as it could be. There's a mess aesthetic of modernism, one that collects all the rubbish and debris, the fragments of our environment, and tries to recirculate them, make value of them, make them into new holes. There's also another side, a stripping down, the side turned towards clearing the decks. In the diary entry and in its form as an essay from 1933 called Experience and Poverty, Benjamin compares the sleek rooms of Bauhaus to the cluttered bourgeois apartments of the late 19th century. These rooms heaved with objects and ornaments, keepsakes, knick-knacks, collectibles and artworks. Benjamin insists that all of this clutter is not there to be inviting and cosy, but rather seems to come to exude possession, to shriek out to any incomer, "You have no business here." The modernist dream in glass and steel was to prevent traces, to eschew the marks of possession and the formation of habits. In February 1933, Benjamin wrote a little piece called Live Without Traces. He contrasted the horror vision of the cluttered bourgeois parlour with the shiny and translucent potential lives to be lived amidst glass and steel, and notes, "Holding on to things has become the monopoly of a few powerful people who, God knows, are no more human than the many. For the most part, they're more barbaric, but not in the good way. Everyone else has to adapt, beginning anew and with few resources." And he has his litany of artists and thinkers who represent that for him. Adolf Loos with his rejection of ornamented facades, and Paul Schierbart with his love of glass buildings and transformative technologies, and Paul Klee, whose figures, Benjamin said, are designed on the drawing board like a car. They possess not innerness but an interior, like a car too, and have something a-human about them. He thinks these figures might be the apt inhabitants of these new stripped-down homes, which become no more than bare lodgings, often modifiable in a flash, people who move on. Even more reduced versions of such Bauhaus homes, ones whose starkness was not by design, but by need, had become Benjamin's habitat at this point. These were homes for people who might need to leave them suddenly in the dead of night. The home is a temporary lodging. The objects it holds are pared down because have become stuff of memory and dream alone. These objects do return in dreams, but may no longer resemble themselves and not what they once were. Or these homes become filled with the junk of everyday existence, with stuff gathered simply to fill a space in the absence of a life. The objects of the new homes are taken from wherever one can find them. Benjamin, of course, has no museum home that can be visited. Exile and poverty ensured that. Some of his possessions that remained in Berlin were seized by the Red Army and archived. Some artifacts, like his watercolour by Paul Klee and Jealous Norvus, and some of his manuscripts, were recovered from friends. He located them with friends because he knew he could not ensure their continued existence. And those, some of them, have found their way back to the Berlin and Frankfurt archives. Most things have been sold and scattered. I just want to turn very briefly to a contemporaneous figure who also encountered new relationships to dwelling and to objects and to memory in the same period. This is not the sleek modernity of Bauhaus, but a kind of parody version of the cluttered bourgeois apartment. Kurt Schwitters, until his exile from Germany in January 1937, lived in Hanover, for the most part, or increasingly over the years, inside an inhabitable sculpture called the Märzbau. Its 8 rooms, which developed over 20 years, enveloped to varying degrees himself, his wife, their son, his parents, their lodgers and their pets. From 1924, Schwitters always slept inside of it. In 1919, at its start, Richard Hülsenbeck, the Dadaist, described it. Schwitters showed us his workroom, which contained a tower. This tower, or tree, or house, had apertures, concavities, and hollows in which Schwitters said he kept souvenirs, photos, birth dates, and other respectable and less respectable data. The room was a mixture of hopeless disarray and meticulous accuracy. You could see incipient collages, wooden sculptures, pictures of stone and plaster, books whose pages rustled in time to our steps were lying about, material of all kinds, rags, limestone, cufflinks, logos of all sizes, newspaper clippings. We asked him for details, but Schwitters shrugged. It's all crap. There's a picture of that. When Hans Richter visited the house in 1925, the column had expanded almost to fill the room on the second floor where it had been placed. Richter described it as a living, daily changing document on Schwitters and his friends. Each of these individual forms had a meaning. There was a Mondrian whole, and there were Arp, Garbo, Duisberg, Lisitsky, Malevich, Mies van der Rohe, and Richter holes. A whole of this. A hole for his son, one for his wife. Each hole contained highly personal details from the life of one of these people. He cut off a lock of my hair and put it in my hole. This was an environment built of memories and personal associations, riddled with grottos, niches, facets and caves, crammed with souvenirs and relics. This was an attempt to hold on to a world of experience that threatened to disappear into memory, or worse. Prominent position was given in the sculpture to the death mask of his firstborn son. In 1931, Schwitters noted that the Märzbau encompassed the development into pure form of everything that has struck me as important and unimportant over the last 7 years. Perverse antiquities were on show until their destruction by British bombers in the war. It must have been as hard to leave the Märzbau as the cave that Benjamin built for himself, a cave of writing and ideas built in Paris. In fact, it was a study of a cave-like interior, the arcades. Montaged iron and glass constructions gave shelter to hectic juxtapositions of shop signs, window displays of merchandise and mannequins, illuminations and reflective glass panes. For the Arcades project, Walter Benjamin organized thousands of transcribed quotations and notes into files, developed a symbol system of cross-references, and presented it all as a vast array of interlinked scraps on which he worked from the time and from 1927 until the time when he had to flee Paris, and it was left incomplete. His friend Gretel Karplus Adorno once joked that Benjamin inhabited the cave-like depths of the Arcades project and did not want to complete it because, she said, you feared having to leave what you built. Schwitters was at home in his self-made environment of the Mertzbau. Benjamin was at home in his Parisian confection. Why should either of them leave? Because they had to. And when Schwitters arrived in Norway, he set about making his second Mertzbau, Das Haus am Backen, a new lodging for the dislodged. He wrote in 1938 about how he intended to make it dismantleable and transportable. That is, it should be a dwelling for one who might need to move it all very suddenly to who knows where. Like scraps in a collage or a montage, the Mertzbau is stuck down in an available or possible place. It forms a whole built of ruins, like the dream does. Haus am Backen had no building permit, and so to obscure it, the building was covered with camouflage and pine needles. Unfortunately, it had to be made too much under the eyes of the police, in view of the police station. There was no comfort there, that these exile homes were not built for comfort. It's now gone, too. When Schwitters made it to the Lake District after internment in Norway and in the Isle of Man, he began another structure, a Mertzbarn. It sinks now, despite campaigns to save it, into the mud. Its most striking part was detached to find refuge in the Hatton Gallery in Newcastle. What have I wanted to say through all this? That the house, the museum, the objects, the self are all carefully intermeshed, but also that a world crashes in, a street cuts through it, history smashes up against the self and resounds. It robs some people and things of any objective existence, leaving just fragments, memories, a dream of something whole and wonderful, worst of all, nothing. Benjamin had no museum made of his things and life. Fragility, historical process overtook both. Schwitters built his own museum, like and unlike anything seen before, but he had to keep starting again. He never finished one, and now they're all but gone. Freud has acquired one, made of the collections that he held on to, as well as made of himself, his life, his practice. Freud was lucky, I suppose, is all I have to say. Despite exile, or perhaps in his case because of it, he could live among the objects, his objects, and now his objects live on for us. For the others, there's only memory, or more creatively, there's only the dream of what was and what might have been. Thank you.
Esther, thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. Right, we have a short Q&A, as I said. Are there any burning questions? I hope there are. Yes, question.
So it's as much kind of expanding on thoughts, so you can respond to it in whichever way you want. But when you... I was interested in where it went, because initially I had a question of... using the sort of bourgeois house with cellar and storage space as a model for the self is quite limiting in the understanding of the self, and particularly with your element of politics. But that was kind of answered already in the paper, that there then has to be an alternative understanding of the space or the house. So does that alternative understanding, that deprivation of this home that has possessions and storage, and alternative understandings of what a home would be or what a space to live in would be, also imply the possibility of alternative understanding of the self or modern man? And a figure that's seen in the background there is Nietzsche, who's both asked for an overcoming of a split between the interior and the external of the person, and praises wanderers and lack of comfort and not being tied down.
I've just got an image flashing into my mind of Nietzsche's house, which is also in Weimar, that was the house of the latter years, very structured by his delightful sister, who got on so well with the National Socialists and
sculpted image in ways. But yeah, I mean, I think it is that. That's precisely it, isn't it? It's the demand for a reevaluation of the self as this porosity, as rootless, but that does go in various ways. That can be just the utter loss of context and deprivation, or it's the modernist, you know, hero, or even the Baudelairean figure, I suppose, who's this, in this kaleidoscope of the modern and moving in and out of a sort of sense of selfhood and utter individuality and full exposure to environment and I suppose a more modern version of that might be the sort of situationist self who succeeds, gives away the autonomy in order to enter into city rhythms and become a sort of deriving wanderer type who's given up any sense of mastery and so on. So I think all of that is certainly implied, while at the same time realizing the compulsion of these things. I mean, I'm fascinated that Benjamin's so interested in the Bauhaus interior, and that just on the cusp of him having to scatter his stuff around Europe and just move from bare lodging to bare lodging, and it's like a grim parody, in a sense, of Taft's idea of, you know, the elegant and empty modernist space.
The idea of perverse antiquities kind of silking down into the cellars and becoming, representing the self. That suggests a kind of rather personal, you know, an intimate process, but both Freud and Schwitters, there seemed to be a public element to the way in which they were collecting and mm-hmm. presenting these materials. Mm-hmm. So is there a play between the idea of the personal and the private, and then the public display and show?
Yeah, I suppose there is, in a sense, there is a similarity, isn't there, in that, I mean, to see Freud, it's a result of being invited in, isn't it, to, it's like the cabinet of curiosities. You're invited in either presumably because you're part of the process of analysis, or you have a reason to be there, and with Schwitters as well, it's, you know, it's the Dadaists go and pay homage and in turn are enfolded into the structure, get their own little hole and so on. So, yeah, I think it's neither personal, it's neither private nor public, but it's a sort of controlled exposure. You know, maybe that's part of it, in a sense. That's the conditions that are being shown, that it goes between those. It sits between those two things. Perhaps transitional, like the woken dream kind of space as well, when you're not sleeping but you're not captured by the light of the day and so on. Again, in between space.
Well, talking of in between spaces,
here we are at one.
I like the analogy of food helping to bury memories. I think we're going to have a break now, so if we'd like to adjourn for tea and coffee and come back, I think it was half an hour. 20 to 12. We'll resume here at 20 to 12, please.